Well, good morning, Summit Church, or good evening if you are watching this at our evening campus. I want to start out today by reiterating something you heard from your campus pastor when you came in, and that is the need at this particular time of the year for some of you to join up with what I consider to be the greatest and one of the most meaningful movements around here, and that is the Summit Church Volunteer Squad. If you realize it or not, I hope you do, but every week hundreds of people help pull off what goes on here. A lot of times people will comment to me about how friendly our church seems on any given Sunday. They'll talk about, you know, I was greeted in the parking lot. There was a guy that met me there with an umbrella. People talked to me when I got in the lobby. People, you know, told me when I got in the sanctuary. That's all because of this team of volunteers. Now, I know that we don't always, you know, score perfectly on that. Maybe you came in today and nobody spoke to you, but that just shows you why we need more volunteers. So we are about this time of year, we start looking to be able to ramp up what we're doing it. We're doing because this is a big place and we want to make sure that we are able to be a ministry to our community. And that's what this allows us to do. We're starting a new season. We need a lot more people. Plus, I will just tell you that you will have a lot more fun here on a Sunday if you are one of these teams. It's a great way to get to know people. It's a sense of knowing that you're doing something that is just really a ministry to the community. We really appreciate around here this team of people that make the Summit Church what it is. In fact, if you are one of our Summit Church volunteers, whether you are a small group leader, kids worker, or whether or not you help people in the parking lot, any of our volunteers, would you, at all of our campuses, would you raise your hand right now? All right, you see that? Now, if you are grateful for these people, raise your hand, okay? And I will consider that your pledge to be a part of these teams. You check out your worship guide, because it really is. It's the way to get the most out of your Summit Church experience, and it's a great thing to be a part of. All right, we are in the middle of a series called Still Standing, in which what we're doing is we're going through the book of Proverbs, looking at the characteristics of the life that is built on the principles of wisdom. And we spent about 3 weeks so far going through some of the foundational principles, talking about how to anchor your life in the rock of wisdom. We've talked about how you can, you know the will of God. Well, this week, what I want to do is talk about something that I believe will be relevant to all of you, something that Proverbs discusses quite a bit, and that is repairing broken relationships. I think I would be on safe ground to say to you that that all of us have broken relationships in our lives. If not now, we've faced them in the past, right? It's always amazing to me how many people have a friend they used to be close to, right? Somebody in their past that they just, now they won't hardly speak to, or they've, had some kind of division between them and that friend. I don't know personally if I've ever met anybody who didn't have somebody that went in that category. Some of you have left a nasty job situation. Maybe you got fired, or maybe you had to remove somebody that had become a friend to you. Maybe you had to walk out on a business partner. Or maybe you haven't left yet. Maybe there's just certain people that you avoid at work because of something that went down. Some of you left churches because of bad relationships, and you've come to this one because you're like, I need a place where people aren't mean and nasty, and you've come in and you've started to get to know us, and I'm going to go ahead and break it to you. This is not that place, okay? If you like us, don't get to know us, okay? Because you like everybody until you really get to know them. I hope that we have a culture of love around here, but we got our own issues. But some of you came out of churches precisely because of broken relationships. Some of you have family conflicts, siblings that you won't speak to, parents, kids that you will no longer talk to. One of the most obvious places that we see damaged relationships is within our marriages, for those of us that are married. This past Tuesday was my anniversary. And Veronica and I celebrated 8 fantastic years of marriage and one other one for a total of 9 years is how long we've been married. We have had our share of conflict. When Veronica got married to me, she thought that she had married the perfect man. You probably could have told her otherwise, but that's not what she thought. Little tip here for those of you that aren't married. If you idolize or are infatuated with someone, don't marry them. Because unless they are virgin born, you're going to find out what total depravity really means. And it was no exception. What's funny is I remember us talking before we got married, giggling together, about how, like, they talk to us about resolving conflict. We're like, we don't really have conflict. We've never really had an argument. You know, that was how we thought about, you know, our marriage. Well, we're the exception. We're not really going to fight. I remember one of our first fights in our marriage was over who would answer the phone. That was one of the big showdowns because both of us hate answering the phone. For some reason, that never came up in premarital counseling. That's like one of the whole reasons I got married was to have somebody to answer the phone. You know, that phone would ring that first year of our marriage, and it would ring, and it would ring, and then it would stop, and then we would have a 10-minute argument about who should have answered the phone. We'd have our tape measure out, you know, measuring who's closer to the phone and should have gone to get it. One of our next fights was over whether or not I should put a bag in the trash can after I had emptied the trash. Because see, after I saw it, the way I saw it, it was my job to empty the trash. I knew that. But putting the new bag in, that's a whole new chore, at least the way I saw it. And I thought she should at least be grateful enough that I emptied the trash to come behind me and put a new bag in. Right? That seemed fair to me. Point is, we've all had conflicts, right? And I'm actually being kind of light about it, but I know that for some of you, this is actually not light at all. It's very serious. Some of you are considering leaving your spouse. Some of you have recently had to walk away from a job, because of this issue. And by the way, some of you, because have been in church for a while, you couldn't actually bring yourself to leave your spouse. Because maybe, you know, the effect you think it would have on your kids, or maybe what you think everybody would say about you. And so what you're doing is you're just shutting down emotionally from your spouse, because leaving to you is not an option, but you still don't know how to deal with conflict, and as a result, you and your partner are getting farther and farther away from each other and more and more distant. All right? Well, Solomon has some incredible wisdom to share with us on why relationships dissolve, how to repair them when they do, or repair them before they do. And Solomon had 700 wives, so I feel like he's probably got a lot to say. All right? Practice makes perfect. Here's what I'm going to do today. I'm going to give you five principles. Five principles that arise repeatedly. I'm just going to give you basically one or two verses on each of these. But if you go back and read, you will find these principles everywhere in Proverbs. Five principles that Proverbs tells you about repairing relationships. I'm going to give it to you all right up front so you won't have any surprises, okay? Number one is react slowly. Number two, you're going to resist superiority. Number three, to release liability. Number four, respond graciously. And number five, remember mercy. Number six is write fast, okay? So, again, react slowly, resist superiority, release liability, respond graciously. And number five, remember mercy, okay? All right, book of Proverbs. I'm going to be all over Proverbs. You can try to keep up. I always like you to have your Bible open, but if you want to follow on the screen, then that'll be good too. The first one, react slowly. Proverbs 15:28, King Solomon says, "The heart of the righteous ponders how to answer, but the mouth of the wicked pours out evil things." When it says pours out, what it means is it gushes out. It's like a reflex. You ever hear somebody say, "Man, they really press my buttons"? And what they mean is that there's a certain key sequence that someone can press into you, and you react a certain way that is fairly predictable. And you need to know that about yourself. You think about the image there, a computer, you press buttons on it, and when you press those buttons, the computer doesn't stop and think about whether or not it wants to do this. It does it immediately. Right? Unless it's a PC, and then it has its own issues, right? But, you know, when you press those buttons, it's a program response. I press control, alternate, delete, and my computer shuts down. It doesn't matter if I didn't mean to press control, alt, delete. It just does it. It is programmed. And what people say is that there are certain things that cause emotions just to gush out of me. Now, unfortunately here, that is bad. Computers don't ponder, and foolish people don't ponder, but righteous people do. Righteous people choose not to react in the moment. They ponder after the moment. And what this does is it allows you to do a couple things. And by the way, the reason I started with this one is because this one thing is going to give you the ability to do the other four. at least in part. If you don't get this one, chances are you'll never get to 2 through 5. Okay? See, reacting slowly allows you, first of all, you're able to get some emotional distance from the issue. All right? Again, this is just really practical. It's just some things look a lot different from a distance, don't they? I've been operating by a rule that I read first in a biography I read of Abraham Lincoln years ago. It's called the 24-hour rule. I have used this for about 7 years now. And in Abraham Lincoln's biography, it says that whenever he got a letter or a conversation that ticked him off, he refused to respond for 24 hours. Sometimes he would go ahead and write the response letter, but he would put it in his drawer and would not send it until he'd reread it 24 hours later. How many of you have done that? To the point that, like, you write something, and then just by the grace of God, you don't hit send. You're like, let me just sit on this for a little bit. And then you read it a day later, and you're like, thank God I did not send that. Right? By contrast, how many of you have gone back and looked at a letter that you sent the day before and thought, if I could just take that back? You know? The emails, conversations I have that tick me off. This is like, I'm going to wait 24 hours because giving myself distance allows me emotionally. They just always look different. You know, in our marriage, when Veronica and I get into a conversation that ticks us off, right? We take a lot of times, I would say all the time, but that's not true. A lot of times we try to take 24 hours. Let's just come back and talk about this tomorrow. Because we will have cooled down. We will, chances are, we'll see things differently from that distance. By the way, conversations can take a long time this way. We're not going to have conversations we've been having for years. Okay, just one phrase at a time, you know, every other night. Right? The 24, I get some distance from it. The whole idea is, again, it's just very practical. It's not even that spiritual. It's just when you have a chance to cool down, things look different. I'd give you an analogy here. In the last couple of years, I've had some sleep issues that I found out ultimately were related to an acid reflux problem I was having. Well, before they diagnosed it, before my doctor gave me some medicine, what would happen is I'd wake up around 3 o'clock just about every night in a horrible mood. And I would be obsessively worried about something in my life, right? Or I would be really ticked off at somebody who had done something, you know, that I didn't like or done something to hurt me. And I would just be really worried about it, or I'd be furious about it. Well, then what I noticed was the next day, you know, when I would think about the same issue, it didn't seem nearly as bad. Or the person really hadn't made me that angry. Right? And so what I had to learn was in the moment when I was angry about it, if I would just wait some distance, it wouldn't look the same. In fact, I told our staff this. I'm like, if I ever call you up at 4 a.m. and fire you, just ignore that, okay? Just ignore it, come right on in, because I didn't mean that. Right? Well, the implication is the same. See, you get the distance from it, and it looks different. It's not like, by the way, it's not like the problems that I was worried about the next day were gone. It's not like the person who I was angry at had no longer offended me. It's just that in that moment, it had gotten so exaggerated that it just took over everything. And so he says the righteous ponders because he gets some emotional distance from it. All right, the other thing this allows you to do is it allows you to see from the other person's perspective, which I don't know about you, I can rarely do in the moment. Proverbs 18:13 says it like this. Solomon comes at it from a different angle. He said, if somebody gives an answer before he hears, it is his folly and his shame. Right? That means when Veronica tells me that she is hurt about something, my initial reaction in the moment is almost always to explain to her why she's not really hurt and why it is irrational for her to even pretend that she's hurt. And that never works. And what I have to do is I have to take 24 hours sometimes, or so even longer than that, and just think, what is she trying to say? Because I want to make sure that I'm hearing her. And hearing does not mean that her, you know, the vibrations from her voice are hitting my eardrum. It means I'm listening, that I'm at least understanding what she's saying and maybe what's behind what she is saying. Maybe she's saying one thing, but there's another hurt that is coming out through there. All right? So that's the first one. You react slowly. This one thing will enable you to do all the others. All right? Or at least give you the opportunities to do all the others. All right? That's number one. Here's number two. Resist superiority. Resist superiority. It's going to come from Proverbs 19:11. I have learned a lot about this particular one from guys like Tim Keller, David Powelson. So let me walk you through this. It's a tad deep, okay? So take a deep breath here. We're about to go to hull crush depth in theology. Proverbs 19:11. Good sense makes one slow to anger, and it is a man's glory or his wisdom to overlook an offense. Now, let me ask a question of this verse. All right. Why is it that being slow to anger means that you have good sense? Why does your ability to overlook an offense mean that you have wisdom or that you have glory? You notice the verse doesn't tell you why. It just says that if you do, you will be slow to anger, right? So what is it about being slow to anger that shows that you have good sense? Well, here's why. One of the core signs in the book of Proverbs that you have understanding or wisdom is that you recognize that the natural inclination of your own heart is to evil. The very first peg of wisdom that Solomon brings up in Proverbs 1 is that if you are wise, you recognize that you are naturally foolish. You remember I said it like this the first week. If you think you are naturally wise, you're a fool. But if you know that you are naturally foolish, well, then you'll be wise. Well, then if you have good sense, watch this, then you know that when somebody does something that hurts you, you recognize that really in your heart, you're made out of the same stuff they are. So you see yourself as the same as them, and you don't automatically despise them for what they did. You tend to be a little bit more sympathetic because you know in your heart you're a fool and you naturally do the same things. Does that make sense? Let's go at it from a different angle. Solomon talks about it this way. Proverbs 11:12. Whoever belittles his neighbor lacks sense, but a man of understanding remains silent. Belittles here means derides or despises or makes fun of. And it says if you make fun of somebody for their fault, you don't have sense because you don't understand that you are very much like that person, at least in some aspects of your heart. Right? Describe it like this. You ever see one of those political cartoons? A political cartoon where somebody is trying to make fun of a politician they don't like? What do? Inevitably. Right? They take some physical characteristic of that politician that is slightly out of balance and they exaggerate it to the point that that's all you see. Right? If it was George Bush, it was always his forehead. With Obama, it's always his ears. So that when you look at that picture, all you see about that person is that one glaring characteristic. Well, that's what we do to people when they have done something that we don't like. Somebody lies to you, they're just a dirty liar. Now you, on the other hand, you know that from time to time you lie, but it's different. Because you had reasons that you lied, and you know, and it's, you're complicated, and you're still really a good person. It's just in the moment you got caught in a lie, but not them. They lied once, they're a dirty liar. That's all you see about them. If they are impatient with you, oh, well, they're just a selfish jerk. But on the other hand, if you were impatient, there were reasons you were impatient. They had no idea what kind of day that you were having, right? And that's why you responded the way that you do. See, a lot of our anger is fueled by the sense that we are fundamentally better than the person who has wronged us. We're different. And so we deride them and we despise them and we paint them with that one characteristic because inwardly, we think we're not really the same, right? Let me be a little psychological on you here. This will be a tad deep. Human beings are almost constantly striving to show they are better than everybody else. And that's because human beings, our natural condition is that we're fundamentally insecure. You see, the human condition is that all of us, deep down, want to call the shots in our lives. We want to play God. And at a very deep level, we all know that this is wrong, so we are insecure and we are constantly looking for self-justification because we're trying to prove that we're all right. That's what's going on in our hearts. Well, when we are offended, that drive for self-justification kicks into hyper mode. And so when somebody hurts us, we think, I would never do that. I am better than the other person. And when you realize that you do what they did, okay? When you realize you do what they did, then you kind of make up reasons about it. You're like, well, I'm complex. So we despise people because we feel superior. And our sense of superiority fuels our anger. But if you see yourself ultimately as the same as them, you wouldn't be so quick to anger. When you see yourself as guilty of essentially the same things that the person who has wronged you is guilty of, well, naturally, you become more sympathetic. The way I've shared this before, a principle I learned early on in my marriage that has been invaluable to Veronica and I, and really in multiple relationships in my life, is first center second sinned against. When I am wronged by her or by anybody else, I tend to think I am sinned against. But when I, in my heart, know, no, I am first and foremost a sinner, and what she is doing to me or what others are doing to me really is the same things that I've done to others or God. For example, every time somebody doesn't think of my needs or they selfishly put their interest above mine, I think about how many times I've done that to God. You know, if I feel like somebody has taken something that has belonged to me, maybe I deserve respect that I didn't get. Well, I think about how many times that I haven't given God His due. Now, I know that some of you are like, but hold on a minute. I haven't done to them what they have done to me. Right? Well, that's why you have to think about it in relation to God. How you have robbed and wronged God. That's the major point in one of Jesus' parables that He told. That's one of my favorites, and I share with you a lot because it is so unbelievably important in our relationships. It's the parable where Jesus talks about the guy that owes 10,000 talents to the other guy. Do you recall this one? All right. So one guy owes another guy 10,000 talents. We don't use talents now, but basically that's like saying, you know, one guy owes another guy a gazillion dollars. It's the kind of debt you could never pay in a lifetime. Right? And so the day of collection comes, and this guy shows up in court, and he says, I don't have the money to pay this back. Right? And then he looks at the guy, and he says, could you have mercy on me? You see, in those days, in Jesus' days, if you owed somebody else money and you couldn't pay it back, then you, by law, were sold into slavery to that person. And not just you, but your wife, and then your kids. And if in all of your lifetimes you couldn't pay off that debt, then your grandchildren would automatically go into debt to that person. So here's a guy who owes this other guy so much money he could never pay it back. And on the day of collection, he stands before the guy and says, I can't do it. And then he does something that everybody thought was crazy. He falls on his knees and he says, please forgive me. Give me some more time. I'll work for you for the rest of my life, but don't make my kids go to prison. Right? And everybody's watching this whole scene and they're thinking, man, this is absurd. Because this guy that loaned this other guy the money, he didn't get to where he was by being a pushover, did he? Right? I mean, it's the same today. What do you call these people? Loan, right? Not loan bunnies, loan puppies, not loan gerbils. You call them loan sharks. Now, you don't pay them back. They show up at your doorstep with a wrought iron and some guy named Bruno breaks your legs. Same thing back then. Right? Everybody's thinking, man, there's no way. And in Jesus' story, a twist takes place that this guy looks at this other guy and he feels something that Jesus calls compassion. And he gets a tear in his eyes get all misty and his voice cracks and his lip quivers and he says, okay, I have grandkids too. You're forgiven. Not just you don't have to go to prison, but you don't owe me any more money. It's all gone. I'll absorb the entire cost of your debt. You are a free man. And nobody in the courtroom can believe it. And this guy stands up, and for the first time in like 20 years, he feels free. And he stands up and he thinks, I'm a free man. I no longer have this debt. And he goes outside. And as he's walking outside, he sees a friend of his crossing the road, and his friend owes him $3 for Chick-fil-A meal that they bought the other day. And he said, hey, where are my $3? I says, man, I don't have your $3. You know, next week I'm getting paid. I'll give you your $3 then. No, I want my $3 now. I just don't have it. Why don't you give me the next week? No, you don't have your $3. You're getting thrown into prison. And takes this guy and hauls him and throws him into prison. Right? Now, at this point in the story that Jesus is telling, everybody's like, that would never happen. Nobody that got forgiven a gazillion dollars would turn around and hold somebody else accountable for $3 and throw them into prison. And Jesus' point was, exactly. So if you cannot forgive others, it's because you have a sense that you've never been forgiven and you see yourself as fundamentally superior to them. And that's a major problem because it makes you a fool. It means you don't understand or know God at all. Let me say that again because we're going to come back to this. If you have a problem with forgiveness, if you have a problem letting go, I'm not trying to be harsh on you. It just shows that you don't understand yourself. And you don't understand God. And that's good news. Let me tell you why. Because it means by learning and believing in who God is and what He has been to you through Jesus Christ, you can be set free from resentment. And some of you have been dominated and controlled by it for years. It is poisoning you. And you can be set free simply by learning that you are first sinner, second sinned against. Here's number three. Third principle. You release liability. Release liability. That's Proverbs 17:9. King Solomon says, whoever covers an offense seeks love, but he who repeats a matter separates even the closest of friends. Now, a couple definitions here. The word covers is not meaning or talking about glossing over an issue where you just pretend it didn't happen and the person keeps trampling all over you and you just let it happen. Now, here's how I know that. Elsewhere, King Solomon, a number of places, will talk about the virtue of confronting somebody when they are in sin. He'll say, for example, the wounds of a friend are better than the kisses of an enemy. And what he's talking about is there is a time when a friend wounds another friend and says, you shouldn't do that, you're hurting other people. It talks about if you correct a wise man, you rebuke a wise man, he will receive it. So he's not talking about just glossing over the issue. The word cover here means much more something like to absorb and to go for love. That's what it'd be something similar to if you were out to dinner with a bunch of your friends, and at the end of the night you said, hey, I'll cover it. What you were not telling them is, let's all leave without paying, right? Let's all run away and pretend this meal never happened. And what you're saying is, I will assume the financial responsibility for the food that you have eaten. The damage you have done to this restaurant, I'll take care of it, right? That's what he's saying here. The one that absorbs, literally in Hebrew it means overwhelm. He who overwhelms an offense seeks after love, seeks after relationship. Okay? That's what it means. The second line of that proverb shows you the opposite of that. Put that back up on the screen if you will. He who repeats a matter separates even the closest of relationships. You see, one line is what you should do. The other line is what we usually do. Right? What you do is you begin to repeat. Here's how it works. When you get offended or wronged or hurt, there's a little tuning fork that goes off inside of you that is put there by the image of God, which says justice has been upset in the universe and repayment must be made. Right? That's what's going on. You feel wronged. You know that something's not right. There's got to be repayment. So here's how you do that. You repay by repeating. There's two or three ways you can do this, depending on your personality. Right? One is you could literally repeat the action back to them. They hurt you, you hurt them. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. You do right back to them what they did to you. Right? Or if you, for whatever reason, can't do that, then you just figure out a way to hurt them like they hurt you. It may take the form of yelling at them. Right? If you're more of the passive type, then, you know, you give them the silent treatment. If you're married, you give them the silent treatment, refuse to, you know, have sex with them. Right? These are all ways of responding. Here's another one that often goes under the radar. I'm not trying to be hard on the women, but a lot of women have learned that they're not yellers, right? They don't want to do that. And so what they do is they just cry. Because they have learned that the way they can really hurt their husband is to cry, and that's a way of getting back at him. Whatever it is, it's simply a way of wounding in response. Remember my sister, when she was 12 years old, she goes here to our church. She was 12, I was 15. I remember it coming out, but she had, you know the verse Jesus said, do unto others as you would have them do unto you? She had memorized that verse 5 years prior as, do one to others as they have done one to you. And so for 5 years, she's been paying me back for everything I have done to her and thinking that she had heaven's blessing on it. Do one to JD as he has done one to me. Right? That's not what it's saying, okay? You can repeat the offense back to them literally. Another way you can do it is you can repeat it verbally to other people. Right? You're actually, because you feel better when you talk about it. You ever notice that? Right? You don't want to do anything back to them because that wouldn't be right, but you'll just go talk about it with all your friends under the guise of a prayer request. But every time you say it, you feel a little bit better because you're slandering them, even though it's true, you're slandering them, and you in your heart are paying them back a little bit every time. Because you're chipping away at their reputation. The third way is you can just repeat it to yourself. Over and over and over again, you just dwell on it, you think about it, you mull it over, you bring it back up. Right? When things are starting to get a little better between you and that person, you rip the scab back open. You think about it, and you're just, listen, you're killing yourself. Even though you never do anything about it, you haven't achieved what the Bible's talking about here. Yeah, I remember learning this partially by a Three Stooges episode. You know, where Mo and Curly, like, I think Mo keeps smacking Curly, and Curly finally says, I'm sick of him smacking me. She says, he ties a stick of dynamite to his chest and says, next time he hits me, he's going to blow his hand off. Yeah, I'll show him. You're hurting yourself, right? In thinking that you're overcoming it, you're just repeating the action to yourself. And the idea is that repayment separates even the closest of friends. Sometimes small things, because people don't understand this principle, end up as huge things because you keep repaying each other back and forth. Anybody got any experience with this? This especially happens in a marriage, right? You just start repaying each other and it just damages after time because nobody knows how to respond the right way. I remember hearing James Dobson tell a story. I read a book about his unforgiveness, and he talks about it. I've shared it with you if you've been here at church for a while. I'm sure you've heard me tell this, but James Dobson talks about this couple, true story, who the wife had, you know, saved up her money and just bought this new blouse. She was really excited about it. Well, of course, she had to wait 3 weeks to get the right shoes to wear with it. So the day came where she could finally put the whole outfit on, and she was super excited about it. All right, so she puts the outfit on, and it's one of those ones that zips up, you know, in the back. And so she asked her husband, "Would you zip this up for me?" And just playing around, you know, he takes it, he zips it, and then just goes up and down 3 or 4 times, just zips it, you know, breaks the zipper. Oh, she is miffed. She has waited. She has been excited about this, and now he has broken the zipper. She can't wear it, and she's just ticked off. So she leaves. She stews over it all day. She comes home, and there's her husband lying underneath the car in their driveway, working on the car. Right? She sees his legs sticking out, you know, from under the car. It's all she goes over to him, and she grabs at his zipper on his pants, zip, 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 you know, back and forth, pays him back. She feels this smug sense of satisfaction that she really, you know, responded to him. She walks inside, goes in the kitchen, and there at the kitchen table is her husband standing at the kitchen table. And she's like, she's like, "What are you doing in here?" He's like, "I live here." And who's under the car? Our neighbor was, you know, fixing something on the car for me. So she rushes out there. She rushes out there, and the guy's passed out cold. Okay, because, you know, he did what any man would do if you grabbed a hold of his zipper and he didn't know what was going on. He sat straight up under the car, popped his head, knocked him out. Right? I mean, this happens, right? Maybe not literally like that, but it happens as you start with something light, something small, and then it increases. I've described it before to, like, you know, it's like you're playing tennis, you know, and your relationship is basically hitting, you know, the ball back and forth to each other, and you're lobbing little love balls back and forth at each other, and all of a sudden somebody puts a little spin on one of them, and you're just put a little spin back on it, and pretty soon you're at the net, like 3 feet from each other, just killing that ball at each other. And what it's saying is, no, that's not what love does. What you have to do is you have to release liability, because if you operate on the eye for an eye principle, then pretty soon both of you are going to be blind, right? You got to release liability. You don't make them repay. Now listen, I know this is hard, right? Because that tuning fork has gone off and you feel wronged, right? And somebody's got to settle the score. And when you get even, right, you feel nigh unto deity when you are getting even with that person, because you know that justice is being restored in the universe. So see, here's the problem. How can you release that driving impulse to get even? Because that impulse is something God gave you about justice. How do you ever get over that? Because if not, you're going to destroy your marriage or any relationship you have. I'll show you how. Look at this. Proverbs 20:22. Solomon says, "Do not say, 'I will repay evil.' Wait for the Lord. He will deliver you." And what's interesting is that Paul quotes this verse in Romans 12 and then adds the phrase after it. I can talk about this all day, but I got to be quick. He adds the phrase, "Vengeance is mine, says the Lord." Now watch this. The way that you lay down the drive for liability is you realize, watch, if this person is a Christian, Jesus has died for them. So when Paul says in Romans 12, "Vengeance is mine, says the Lord," in an incredible way, Jesus literally said, the vengeance for that wrongdoing is mine. I'll take it. So when they sin against me, whether it's my wife or a friend, I say, I thank God that Jesus died for the sin. That He absorbed the vengeance for what they had just done, what they had committed. If they're not a Christian, well then, I know that God one day promises He will settle all scores. Vengeance is mine. He will repay vengeance. It is His. So watch this. Every night before you go to bed, you are either putting your anger on the cross on one side, or you're putting it into hell on the other. Either Jesus died for this, or God will repay it fully in eternity. Either way, I don't have to carry around the bitterness of vengeance in my soul. You see, either way, I'm saying, I'm not going to bear this. Either Jesus took it on the cross, and I thank God that He died for their sin and mine. Or if they're not a Christian, I know one day God will repay. God will settle all scores. I don't have to carry the burden of vengeance around. I can release this. This is not the whole package of forgiveness, but this is such a crucial part of it. Here's number four. You respond graciously. Respond graciously. That's going to be Proverbs 25, 21, and 22. Look at this. If your enemy is hungry, give him bread to eat. If he's thirsty, give him water to drink. For you will heap burning coals on his head. By the way, Paul also quotes this in Romans 12. And I've always loved that image, heap burning coals on his head. Because I thought, well, that's exactly what I wanted to do in the first place. So why not skip all the hungry, thirsty bit and just go ahead and heap the burning coals? God, I'll take care of that one, okay? You see how that's odd? I mean, what's God going after? Because if you really do want to heap burning coals on their head, you're going against the very spirit of what He just told you to do, right? Here's why. What He means by heap burning coals is you are awakening the conscience of the person that did that to you. That's the image of heaping burning coals. You're not heaping burning coals on them so their head will incinerate. You're heaping burning coals because through the grace of your wrong actions, you wake them up. When you are nice to someone who is a jerk to you, quite often your kindness confronts them with the guilt of what they're doing. Heaping coals of fire on them is awakening their sense of conscience. Let me tell you a little gospel secret that nobody seems to get. Right, and that is, we think that the way that you change somebody is to make them pay, to berate them, to be sarcastic with them. How many of you that works in your marriage? It doesn't, all right? I mean, a little gospel secret. Grace is how you change somebody. I know this is obvious for those of you that are married, but very few people in the midst of an argument, whether you're married or not, very few people in the midst of an argument suddenly go, oh, you totally just put me in my place. Now that you have yelled at me and humiliated me and berated me, now I see the error of my ways. Your sparkling logic has removed my stupidity from me. Thank you. Let me change right now. That has never happened in my marriage. It's never happened in any relationship. I had to learn in Proverbs 15:1, Solomon says, it's a soft answer that turns away wrath. It's a harsh word that stirs up anger. Undeserved grace is a more effective change agent than my wrath is. That is so counterintuitive that unless you just went, oh, that's totally opposite of how I work. God cuts me off in the interstate. I'm going to show Him by cutting him off back. That's how I'm going to change the guy. I'm going to do a favor to humanity by cutting this guy off and showing him how it makes me feel. Right? Unless this is blowing your mind, you haven't heard what I've said yet. The way that you change somebody, according to Proverbs, is not by responding with repayment, but by responding with undeserved kindness. The clearest way this was ever described, I think, is when Jesus gave us the concept of what has to be in His top five of most misunderstood teachings. The concept of turning the other cheek. And Jesus said, if you are struck on the cheek, offer to the other person your other one. And you're like, well, what does that mean? Somebody's physically attacking you, trying to kill you, and you stand there and you just keep taking it? Bring it on! My cheek's still got some skin left on it. Come on! You're like, what does that mean? Well, look, I'm not in martial arts. I've never been in martial arts, but I've got friends in martial arts. And I've asked, no one has ever told me that the way that you actually physically harm somebody is by going after their cheek. When you want to really do damage, when you want to kill them, go for their cheek. The person in Jesus' story is not trying to physically harm the other person. It's not the image. In Jewish thought, as in our thought, the face symbolized the relationship. Okay? Even more so for a Jewish person, because their common greeting in the street was to kiss one another on the cheek. So when you smack somebody in the face, the image is you are totally despising the relationship. You are insulting them. And what you are saying to them is, I don't want a relationship with you, and I do something that is offensive in a way that I know destroys the relationship. And when that happens, Jesus says, you've got a choice. When that person has wounded the relationship, you could go back for their cheek. Right? You just insulted me, now I'm going to insult you. Or, he said, you could turn to them the other cheek, which is to reoffer the relationship to them on the basis of kindness. He didn't even say you turn the same cheek to them. You turn the other one and you say, you have attacked, but I'm not going to respond. I'm going to reoffer you the relationship. Sometimes, by the way, that includes confronting them. Because letting someone continue to live in sin is the most unloving thing that you can do for them. To not point out their behavior is unloving for them. It's also unloving for all the other people that are going to be hurt through what they do. So turning the other cheek does not mean never confronting them. It's just that when you confront them, you're not trying to get even. You're not trying to make them pay. You're doing it out of love for them. Your confrontation is without the slightest drip of personal rancor, of malice. You're not speaking out of a sense of personal woundedness. You're speaking out of love. And the goal is not to punish. The goal is to restore relationship and to heal. See? Now before I leave this, let me make something clear. What Solomon is doing is not giving you these tips, okay? He's not saying, hey, here's a way to fix relationship. This is a very serious matter. God takes our refusal to forgive, to do this, what we're talking about, very seriously. Look at Proverbs 24:17. Look at this one. Solomon says, do not rejoice when your enemy falls. Let not your heart be glad when he stumbles. Lest the Lord see it and he be displeased and turn away his anger from him. And again, here's a little mystery. Is Solomon saying that the way to keep God angry at somebody is to make sure you're not angry at him? So this is like some kind of subplot as a way to, you know, I don't want God to quit being angry at you, so I'm going to be nice to you, so God will really get you. No. The implication is God will turn away his anger from that person onto you. Because God takes our refusal to forgive very seriously. In fact, let me just say it like this. This is a little... Our hatred and our unforgiveness of the one who has hurt us is as offensive to God as the initial act is. Because it demonstrates a complete lack of knowledge of who God is and how he's cared for you. I'll say that again. Our refusal to forgive, our nursing of hatred and resentment, is as offensive to God as the initial act was. And what he's saying is, if you can't let go of that resentment, God takes that very seriously. I'm not trying to drop a bomb on you, okay? I'm just saying, this is a very serious issue because it means you don't understand who God is, how he's loved you. Here's number six, or number five. Remember mercy. Remember mercy. How do you do all this? I can stand up here all day long and say, you need to resist the need for superiority. You need to release liability. You need to respond graciously. And this is where it falls apart for some people, doesn't it? Right? You're like, I don't know how to do this. You can tell me to do it, but, you know, to err is human, to forgive is divine. I'm not divine. I don't know how to do it. I know. Okay? In fact, if this makes you feel better, I was reading a book a girl named Becky Pippert, who's written a lot of books on this type of subject. She was a PhD in psychology from Harvard. And she talks about in one of her classes at Harvard, the professor getting up and explaining, it was a case study, where they learned that what was driving this guy in his life was his anger and resentment toward his mother. And then Becky Pippert says, after they isolated what the problem was, he just moved on to the next case. And so she raised her hand and she said, wait a minute, professor. We've isolated that this is his problem, but we haven't talked about how he gets over that. He said, well, that's not the role. We're not trying to get over it. And she said, well, what am I supposed to do with this guy? He says, well, once you teach him what it is, then you just teach him to try to, you know, hopefully not let it drive all the different parts of his life. Just teach him that it's there. Well, all the people in the class begin to ask these questions. They're like, well, how do we teach someone how to forgive somebody else? And the professor responds. This is in her book. She says, the professor responded by saying, who says you're supposed to forgive? He goes, you're supposed to know that it's there and not let it drive you. You can't force Christian morality of forgiveness onto a psychological situation. And all the students are kind of sitting there going, forcing Christian morality? You just got to get it. He said, listen. He said, if you want to teach someone how to forgive, you're in the wrong department. The psychology's role is to identify the problem, not provide the solution. And he actually is speaking quite wisely at that point. Because a lot of things can identify the problem. What is it that gives you the capacity and the ability to forgive? All these coping mechanisms we have, counting to 10, it doesn't remove that issue, see? You've got to find the capacity to forgive somewhere else. And that's what Solomon says here, Proverbs 16, look at this. By steadfast love and faithfulness, iniquity is atoned for. By the fear of the Lord, one turns away from an evil heart. You get that? It's by your relationship with God, watch, that you're going to be able to turn away from these evil behaviors. To turn away from evil, watch. You have to, evil, and what I mean by that is resentment and hatred and unforgiveness. You have to understand how your sin was atoned for. Atoned literally means paid. How was your sin paid for according to this verse? Look. By steadfast love and faithfulness. These two words, steadfast love and faithfulness, are hard to put together because they raise a dilemma. God loves us steadfastly on one hand, yet the word faithful means He is just and He is righteous. So here is the dilemma. How could God love us steadfastly while at the same time remaining just in His treatment of our sin? This verse points you toward the cross of Jesus Christ. Because at the cross, the just demands of the law were met when Jesus died in our place. Our sins were paid for in totality at the cross. There, Jesus absorbed the penalty. He didn't just brush it aside. He absorbed it. There, Jesus responded graciously. There, Jesus, who was superior, turned His back on His superior position and took the role of a slave and a criminal in our place so that I could be saved. When you see that, when you see that God values you, see, you lose the need for self-justification because you have the approval of the only one who really matters. When you see that God has absorbed the pain of your sin, you will be able to do it for others. One final story I'll share with you. I read this. South Africa, 1970s. Nelson Mandela was released from prison after he'd been held for 27 years on what most people conclude were severely unjust charges. When he was released from prison, he was elected president of South Africa. You may recall this. One of the first things he did as president was he set up something called the TRC, the Truth and Reconciliation Committee. And what Nelson Mandela wisely knew was that when a oppressed people, like the black people of South Africa, had suddenly come to power, history showed that they would often spend 20 or 30 years getting vengeance on the people who had oppressed them. So Nelson Mandela's Truth and Reconciliation Committee had one basic rule, and that is if one of the white oppressors, one of the government people or one of the policemen, would come forward and acknowledge his wrong, then he could not be put on trial for that. And as for forgiveness, he could not be put on trial for that crime. It was a bold move, but it saved, in many ways, the peace of South Africa. All right, there was one story that particularly grabbed my attention. It was an 81-year-old woman. Who she was summoned to the courtroom, and there was a white policeman there who acknowledged in his terms, again, this is his words, not hers. He said her 18-year-old son I drug him out and shot him in the back of the head. And then to try to conceal the evidence, I burned his body so that there was no trace of him left. He said, then, 10 years later, I came back and took that boy's father, your husband. And he says, and I took him out, tied him to a wood pile, poured gasoline over him, and burned him alive. He acknowledged this to this woman there in that courtroom, and as you could imagine, there was a hush. As everybody wondered how this woman was going to respond. By the way, this 81-year-old woman, when he had done that to her husband, she was forced to watch. He did it right in front of her. The judge then gave the elderly woman a chance to respond. And the judge asked her, what do you want from Mr. Van de Broek? That was the policeman's name. The courtroom waited in hushed silence. Finally, she said that she would like him, the policeman, to go to the spot where he burned her husband's body and gather up the dust so that she could give him a decent burial. The policeman, head down, nodded. Then she added further that she forgave him and that God forgave him. And to prove that to him and that the forgiveness she was giving was real, she wanted to embrace him right there in the courtroom. And then she said, my only requirement, my request is that he come to her ghetto twice a month to spend the day with her so that she could be a mother to him and give him some of the love that she still had left to give. And the author in this story writes, justice was not done in South Africa that day. Steadfast love and faithfulness wipe out sin because it absorbs the effects of sin into itself because that's what Jesus did for them and then loves like God's love. Where do you learn that kind of love? You can't learn it even at Harvard University in a psychology class. You only learn that kind of love at the cross. Love like that flows out from experiencing love first. So what I'm telling you is you can overcome the resentment and the bitterness that is dominating you. You can. But it's going to start with a cross. I know that some of you are hurt. But I'm telling you, your resentment is poisoning your soul. It is controlling you, and you need to make a decision this morning or tonight or whenever you're hearing this. You need to make a decision to release it because it is killing you. Jesus can give you the ability to let this go. He can give you the ability to release it. He can take the bitter waters of your heart, that resentment, and He can make them sweet. But you have to start by letting Him love you, by surrendering to His plan and letting Him have control. In other words, what I'm telling you is in order for this relationship, these horizontal ones to be right, this one's got to be right first. And if you will come to Him, you don't have to be controlled by this anymore. Through Him, through the experience of His love, the rest of your life doesn't have to be controlled by bitterness. The rest of your life can become the best of your life. But it starts with Him. And it starts with surrendering to Him and receiving His plan. Why don't you bow your heads with me, if you would. All of our campuses, if you bow your heads. For those of you that struggle with resentment, unforgiveness, would you just you pray this with me? Think about the words I'm saying and pray them back to God. Say, God, I admit that I've been hurt by other people. I also admit that my own habits and hang-ups have hurt others. Right now, I embrace the forgiveness that has been offered to me through Jesus Christ. Through His power, God, I will forgive those or that one who has hurt me. Say, Jesus, I reach out to You today. And if you've never accepted Jesus Christ into your life, right, I want you to say this in your own words to Him, if this is true. Jesus, as much as I know how, I let You have the controls in my life. If you've never received Christ as your Lord and Savior, say, Jesus, as much as I know how, right now I let You have the controls of my life. Jesus, I accept Your offer to save me and make me new. Jesus, make Yourself real to me and change my life. Jesus, make yourself real to me and change my life. Father, I pray for those who have come face to face with what has driven their life. I pray that today they would find the release from resentment and they would find the healing waters of Jesus Christ. God, for those who for the first time have received you as Lord and Savior, God, show them the steps they are to take and show them how you can make all things new, that today they are beginning not just a new chapter, but a whole new book of their life. I pray and ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.